in a lot of organizations, there can be this tension that, you know, can sometimes manifest itself in an unhealthy way between engineering and product want to do something, and security says, no, you can't do that, or you can't do that until we've had, you know, our 2 cents on it. And really what I find is a lot of that comes from not having a model where everybody's marching to the same thing, and you don't necessarily have security transparency. So how we think about it is, security starts with your developers internally, right? I mean, at an organization like GitHub, we're very engineering driven and engineering led culture. We have a security team that I think in many ways mirrors that, especially by virtue of them all reporting up to the same leader. And the focus is really on how does the security team reliably and repeatably get great security outcomes when they're not in the room.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. Welcome to the Modern Security Podcast, where we interview security leaders at forward-thinking companies building effective and scalable security programs, and then share what we learn so we can push the industry forward together. So I'm the head of security research at SendGrep, and I run the TLDRSec newsletter, which is a nice way to keep up with the latest and greatest in security across a broad variety of topics every week for free. And today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Mike Hanley, who was the VP of security at Duo, then was the CISO at Cisco, and is now the Chief Security Officer and SVP of Engineering at GitHub. Mike, thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you today. Thanks, Clint, for the opportunity. Looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about a bunch of interesting stuff, a little bit about Mike's background and what brought him here today. Also, how GitHub is using AI internally, both for themselves as well as in various product features. And then we'll spend some time talking about, you know, what's next for AI, whether that's at GitHub or just the impact of AI on cybersecurity in general. And one thing that I think is super exciting about this is, in many ways, I feel like GitHub is at the forefront of this with Copilot and other things. So yeah, very much looking forward to this. So starting off with your background, one thing I was curious about is, well, I guess I'll let you say a little bit about yourself.
Sure, yeah. So as you mentioned in the beginning, I have two hats at GitHub. I have the good fortune of being the Chief Security Officer and the SVP of Engineering here. And the latter piece of that came about probably a year and a half ago, where I picked up leading the engineering organization as well. And I'm sure we'll kind of get to a little bit of what that blend looks like in a bit, so I'll save that. Prior to joining GitHub as the first Chief Security Officer here, I was the CISO at Cisco. I spent about 3 years at Cisco after they acquired Duo Security in 2018. And I joined Duo back in 2015 when it was a tiny startup. And I remember onboarding in the basement of the little building that we have here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Duo was headquartered. And prior to that, did sort of the federal space. So after I got out of graduate school at Carnegie Mellon, I did one of those scholarship programs called Scholarship for Service, where the government pays for school and you pay them back time afterwards. So I worked at the CERT Coordination Center at Carnegie Mellon for several years after I did my master's. So I've kind of done federal, have done startup, have done enterprise, and now have the good fortune of leading engineering and security at GitHub.
Nice. Yeah, that's so cool. I feel like you have a really interesting perspective across like a broad variety of types of things, which, yeah, I would love to get into in detail in potentially the future. Speaking of your blended role at GitHub in terms of both having a very senior role in engineering as well as security, I think a lot of companies have, ideally, those two teams and orgs are sort of collaborative, but sometimes they're not. And in some ways, you know, shipping more features and faster is obviously good for product and eng. And then security is like, oh, yeah, we want to help you do that, but maybe more securely. So there's some friction there. And yeah, I'm curious how you sort of like have those like two hats that you're balancing. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Sure. So, you know, I'll talk a little bit about the security mission first at GitHub, and then I'll talk a little bit about how we blend security and engineering together. So first, at a high level, you know, GitHub basically has kind of three pillars of the security mission at GitHub. The first is, you know, the same thing you would have in any other security leadership role, where I'm responsible for keeping GitHub, the company, and the employees and the, you know, the corporate systems secure and protecting our data. So that's kind of the standard CISO mission. The second one is all of the work around product security. So making sure the product and platform and capabilities and services that we build are all secure. So that's your product and ProdSec mission. And then the third one, which is a little bit unique to GitHub by virtue of being a platform where people are coming together to create, is we also have a responsibility and an obligation really to help make security better for everybody, if you think about it. And we're in a very unique position to do that, whether that's in the form of novel security research or going out and helping open source developers adopt security capabilities or helping them with security expertise, or if it's trying to say, well, let's raise the security bar for everybody by getting two-factor authentication turned on for, you know, millions and millions and millions of developers who use GitHub.com. Those are the kinds of things where I think as just a platform, we're in a unique position to make a difference. And that is one of the more unique things, but certainly one of my favorite parts of the job on the security side. Now, I did mention in the intro, and you're sort of getting to this in your question of like, well, but you do both of those things. You run security and the engineering team. And I will say, like, I am a pretty firm believer that the best security work actually happens in engineering teams and as close as possible to where the product development work is happening. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, in a lot of organizations, there can be this tension that, you know, can sometimes manifest itself in an unhealthy way between engineering and product want to do something, and security says, no, you can't do that, or you can't do that until we've had, you know, our 2 cents on it. And really what I find is a lot of that comes from not having a model where everybody's marching to the same thing and you don't necessarily have security transparency. So how we think about it is security starts with your developers internally, right? I mean, at an organization like GitHub, we're very engineering driven and engineering led culture. We have a security team that I think in many ways mirrors that, especially by virtue of them all reporting up to the same leader. And the focus is really on how does the security team reliably and repeatably get great security outcomes when they're not in the room. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the charge for that group. And that is through building safe and secure defaults. That's through building the right security enablement for the engineering teams. That's through embedding as early as possible in the process to support the engineers and all the work that they're doing from idea to actually shipping and operating something. Mm-hmm. And not having that, hey, let's call the security team right before we ship this thing and see if they can make sure it's good to go, which is kind of the model that you were talking about. And I've seen this before, totally. and it's challenging, right? Because it's a misaligned set of incentives. It's it's often a communication challenge. And I just find that if the security teams are working out in the open and they're really everybody sees that they're on the same side of the table trying to achieve the same thing, you can actually go much faster, go much more confidently, and you can realize better security outcomes if you have this mindset that we want to focus on making sure things go right and having that be equally as important as preventing the bad things from happening.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that a lot. A couple of things that I was curious about. One thing you said that I really liked is like, how do we make sure the right thing happens when a security person is not sort of specifically in the room? I'm curious how you think about like maybe how much of this investment is say like a security champions program versus creating some sort of like self-service threat modeling infrastructure, obviously secure defaults and things like that. I'm a huge believer and proponent in, and I try to talk about it a lot. And a number of the discussions with other people I've had with like Jacob Selassie at Snowflake or Dev at Figma and people like that all have been like influencing or also saying sort of secure defaults and things like that. But I find sometimes that companies, just speaking with friends of mine, even if you believe in that sort of philosophy, it's not always easy. So I don't know. So I just listed a bunch of things, but I'm curious if there's any of those you want to take a stab at.
No, that's great. I mean, I can give you a little bit of a narrative example that might help illustrate this point and why it can be more work to try to get this stuff right, but you ultimately get to better outcomes. And frankly, you get to better shared understanding of like why security is important and what everyone's contribution to that actually is in the grand scheme of things. So for those of you who have been using, you know, GitHub for a long time, you'll know that like personal access tokens, historically, you know, you would mint one, they had lots of access, they didn't have any expiration on them. And we redesigned that flow so that you have principle of least privilege and you have sort of safe defaults, you have a default expiry time when you mint a personal access token now. So we've expressed some security best practices in the product and the way that feature is actually designed and deployed. But, you know, organizations need to go from like the old thing to the new thing. And GitHub had to do that as well in terms of how we, you know, we're dogfooding that as a feature and capability that we wanted to ultimately deliver to our customers and open source developers. So when we did that, it wasn't just a like, hey, everybody go nuke your old personal access tokens and mint one of the new ones that's the new and improved. That would not have gone well because, frankly, not every developer knows what the right defaults were that we would have wanted them to pick. They may not necessarily know where all the paths were that they had used. And that's just sort of hard. That's like a hard exercise, right? Because it takes work to rotate keys and credentials just generally in any setting and context. So we spent a lot of time, first off, being clear about what we were doing and why. Like, why are we changing the way this product feature works? And why is this good for customers? And why is it good for us internally to adopt that first and make sure that we're doing this in a way that is has the right amount of friction in the right places to realize the desired outcome, which is overall better security. And then we spent a lot of time figuring out how to actually enable all the engineers who needed to actually go through this, which was the vast majority of them, to actually have that be as frictionless of a process as possible. So building the inventory of paths, where was the last place that it was seen? Helping them actually keep track of their progress, reminding them of what we needed them to do, having a paved path toward what the right kind of paths or what the right practices were to mint going forward. Those are the kinds of things that we did to actually help make sure that that was a streamlined process. Similarly, you know, we're a, I only have the small one in front of me, but you know, we have the little FIDO tokens as hopefully many of your listeners do. But when we moved to requiring not just FIDO or WebAuthn everywhere, but also requiring you to do like a step-up authentication or authorization to actually log into something. So anytime you go to a privileged application at GitHub, you have to sort of do a just-in-time checkout. You interact with this interstitial that says, hey, Mike, it looks like you're trying to do this. You know, log your business justification for what you're trying to do and you know, tell us how many hours you need to carry this privilege so that you're not always running around with a bazooka. And a lot of that, again, was that was a big change in workflow. But we really started with the like, why is this the right thing to do for the company and for customers and the security of GitHub at large? And then what are we going to do to make transitioning to this new control as easy as possible for all of you so that you understand why we're doing it, but that we've thoughtfully designed the process so that it's not a bad experience? Because we all know what happens if you design bad security experiences. People figure out, you know, what is the way that I can get around or have to avoid that interaction. So this idea that you can have strong security capabilities, healthy security processes, to me, to get people to really buy into that and really be behind the idea of it and really embrace that they've got to have this as part of doing the work, you have to really spend the time talking to the people who are going to be affected by it and figuring out how do you realize the security goal but also have happy developers. And those are not opposing ideas, but it takes a lot of effort and energy to make sure that you get that right. And as I'm sure you know and can appreciate, right, the security industry doesn't really have a great track record of this over the course of the last several decades. We're really good at building security tools that are extremely painful for people to use. And the example that I love to give of that is, if you remember back in, I think it was the late 90s, I think it was 1999, Alma Witten wrote that paper, Why Johnny Can't Encrypt. And it was that usability study of PGP5 back in the day. And basically what, you know, the finding of that is that a lot of people, you know, a lot of security technologies aren't built for the security layperson. And the reality is most of the people we work with on a day-to-day basis are not security experts. So we need to build for them and really thoughtfully design tools for people who do not have security expertise so they can get the desired outcomes of those controls. So, you know, this whole security is the department of no, or the, you know, department of being completely opaque. That model, I don't feel like works in a modern development shop and at the modern speed of business, frankly, not even just software development, but of business generally.
Agreed. Yeah. I like the emphasis on like how does security enable the business. And yeah, I would recommend people to check out the Why Johnny Can't Encrypt. Really great.
And basically every year or two, there's a revisitation of the title by, you know, Why Johnny Can't Encrypt, or Why They Still Can't Encrypt. So it's a well-studied topic and suggests we're not making as much progress as we could in the space on this generally. But that's definitely my charge to the listeners, is to think deeply about that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, a big thing that I, along those lines, always try to encourage and think about is, like, how can we make security as transparent and easy for developers and people who are sort of security lay as possible in terms of you know, lots of people are going about doing their jobs and they want to be secure, but also it's not their core job responsibility. Like it's probably, it's like part of it, but like, how can we make it almost like orthogonal and like transparent to them where they, one metaphor I like to give is you are driving in a car. You're probably not an expert in car safety, but if you put on your seatbelt and you have an airbag, which is built in, which you don't need to do anything specifically new or different, you don't need to be like a mechanical engineer to like be safe driving a car. Similarly, if you're using GitHub or another platform, ideally, you know, you have to do some things, but like ideally as much as possible, it just sort of happens transparently around you and you don't need to be maybe super focused on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great analogy. And I would say the, again, if you believe that the vast majority of people who are interacting with security technology on a day-to-day basis are not security experts, there's sort of no bonus points for having something that's, you know, so secure that nobody can get their work done, or it's built in such a way where people can't interact with it clearly. And that's where I feel like the transparency piece of it, and starting from a position of, as the executive is responsible for risk, or as the person on the security team is responsible for managing risk and making sure that some security things continue to be true about our business, whether it's a customer commitment or a best practice or a control that we care about, making sure that those things still are true, you got to kind of look at your partners across the table and say, like, I'm going to start with the assumption that we're going to be able to get to a yes on what you need to do. And being the department of yes and. So if the finance team says, hey, we want to use you know, this new thing and migrate all of our finance data to this new platform, saying yes and, let's talk about what controls are possible, or how we need to protect customer data, or how we need to protect our financials, or how you can interact with that securely, or how it interacts with our identity stack. Figuring out like how you get to those yeses of, I want to help the people who know the know best what we need to do in finance, or know best what we need to do in sales, or know best what we need to do in marketing, or know best what we need to do in an engineering feature team, help them interact with you in such a way and with the security controls in such a way where both things are true, right? That you get the business outcome that you want, but also that you maintain, sustain, or frankly, even improve the security posture that you have along the way. And, you know, you always hear this too. And I mean, I actually just heard this from somebody the other day. There was a comment of like, well, people are always the weakest link. And it's, no, that's not true. The people are actually your best asset. And really what you want is for people to know enough that security is important and know where to go to ask for help. And it's really building that trust and transparency that allows you to have an environment where you can kind of deputize to some degree, really all of the employees, and bring them into the fold of the security process. That is actually your best advantage and asset as a security team. We'll never have enough people to shoulder surf every single employee and make sure that they're always doing the right thing all the time. And that's not a winning strategy or a right strategy for a business anyway. So, you know, again, building that culture where security is understood to be important, but you've built that transparency and that shared understanding, and really that, again, as a security executive in particular, you are communicative and telling the story about why that matters. It just goes a long way in terms of helping bring people along and then actually achieve those good security outcomes that you care about.
Agreed. And something you said before about, you know, you're not always able to be in the room or have a security person in the room. So if you have sort of the culture of people are like, oh, hey, I'm doing this one thing. It sounds like I might want security team's advice on this, and also to have built up their reputation such that they're like, oh yeah, and they're going to be super helpful. They're going to help me get my job done faster, and they're not going to just be like, oh, whoa, you can't do this at all. So knowing when to reach out and then feeling confident that it's going to be a good experience when you reach out, to your point, culture.
Yeah, is key. Exactly. That's right. And you can build in the right guardrails to assure that these things happen, right? So you might say, hey, if a service doesn't have a security review on file in the last 6 months, we'll mark it non-deployable, but we'll also tell people 2 months ahead of time that they need to start the review process to make sure that they don't end up in that situation. So you can kind of thoughtfully build technology and process and the people-to-people interactions to make sure that those things continue to remain true and you don't totally rely on people always raising their hand in those situations. So I think that's that thoughtful sort of defense in depth strategy that kind of covers all of those things.
Nice. I like that. So moving on to AI at GitHub, I'm curious if you'd like to share a little bit about how GitHub uses AI for itself, whether security teams or engineering productivity, things like that. I know one thing you mentioned when we were chatting before is how there's been some iteration on getting the code generated by Copilot to be even more secure over time. So yeah, just lots of stuff to discuss in there, but yeah, wherever you'd like to start.
Yeah, I would say we as a company have fully embraced AI, and not just from a developer tools productivity standpoint in the sense that we're building and shipping GitHub Copilot, but also we're adding AI capabilities to a lot of other product areas. And then we also just have some internal use cases for AI as well that I can talk about in a second. If you go back in the clock a little bit, I mean, I've been at GitHub for about 3 years now. And shortly after I joined, I saw the first internal demo of Copilit and of GitHub Copilit. And I remember having that double take moment where after I saw the demo, I went and I rewound the recording and said, did I see what I thought I just saw? And it was like, yep, I did see what I thought I just saw. And mind you, that was almost three years ago now. And GitHub has been using internally since that time, Copilot. And every engineer uses Copilot every day to build GitHub.com, the GitHub mobile application, every part of our platform to do their job. So we've been really soaking in this for more than 2.5 years at this point of actually having operational experience with GitHub Copilot as a AI pair programmer for our engineers. Now, we built up the corpus of knowledge from that, but what's also true is we've now seen the initial sets of changes since AI became more mainstream in the sense of it being a developer productivity tool. So obviously people got to experience that when we did the technology preview, where we made it available for people to sign up and use GitHub, use GitHub Copilot. We've seen it through changes in models and improvements in models under the hood that are powering those experiences. Obviously we saw ChatGPT, this is a little 15, 16 months ago when that sort of came on the scene and introduced a new modality for interacting with AI. And what I can say pretty confidently is we're all in, and the pace of change here, I think, is only getting faster, which if you are an optimist about what AI can do for us royally, but specifically in like developer tools and security, I think there's a lot of reason to be excited. And I think back in the spirit of our earlier question, I think there's a lot of reason to figure out how to get to yes in your organization on how to incorporate AI into some of your workflows. So, you know, I mentioned we're using GitHub Copilot for, you know, when people are actually sitting down at the editor and building, building their day-to-day work. But there's also things like, obviously, with Copilot Chat, I can ask a question about the file that I'm looking at. So if I'm a new engineer and I'm onboarding and I'm learning GitHub's monolith, for example, the fact that I can just ask a question of like, hey, what is going on in what I'm looking at right now? Or can you summarize this for me? Or, we have some abilities to, interact with repositories by asking questions about them. Those types of experiences. And so it's not just the like helping me write code, but overall the productivity mm-hmm. improvement on those has been massive for our engineers internally. And we're excited to kind of continue to bring those experiences to places where we feel like we can make developers that much more happy, that much more effective, including in the security products work that we're doing, where we've now got the ability to automatically fix things that our code scanning tech finds for you. So instead of just finding it and saying, hey, Clint, here's an issue that you should look at. Now we say, hey, here's an issue that you should look at. And by the way, we're fixing it for you. And here's why this was the right fix to explain the issue so that you have an opportunity to actually see, understand, and then learn from that. I think that's a powerful improvement, I think, in security workflows, to go from just having a thing and knowing that you need to do something to having it done for you and having context and explanation as to why that was the right thing is very powerful. There's also just internal use cases, like, for example, summarizing snippets and discussion posts across the board. GitHub has internally many hundreds, if not into the low thousands number of services. And each one of those generally corresponds to a repository, and teams are having conversations in different repositories using GitHub discussions. And we do have an internal app that sucks up a lot of those discussions each day and summarizes them. And that is using some of the Azure OpenAI API endpoints to help us with that. So we've got some internal use cases like that as well. But there's also just, internal sort of IT tools and things like that that we're bringing on. And again, I feel very bullish that we are in a permanent transformation of how work is getting done, not just software development. and teams and companies that embrace and lean into like, okay, great. How do we get this right? And how do we make this happen? Because this becomes a huge advantage for us. We'll thrive. And I think it will be challenging for businesses, for teams to keep pace if they don't figure out how to get to a yes on that. So this goes back to the mindset of being the department of yes and. I think now is a great time for security folks to say yes and ask hard questions, but work hard also to figure out how to get to a yes to AI in their organizations.
Yeah, yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of compelling cases for being enabling the business and allowing shipping products faster and things like that. So you listed a number of cool applications in terms of so Copilot, in terms of maybe generating code faster, asking questions about a code base, so more of like a code understanding. You talked about autofix in the GitHub security product suite. By the way, I wanted to give a shout out to that team. They had a blog post recently that I thought did a really excellent job about just like actually getting into detail. Like, I feel like I see a lot of blog posts that are like, they read a bit to me like, hey, here's our first attempt and here's like our POC of doing this thing. And it tends to be not very rigorous or not a lot of details, but I felt like that blog post actually did an excellent job about like, okay, here's like we've really thought this through and here's like the different layers that we all sort of put together to make it more effective. So that was, I think, a level of detail that we can link it in the show notes, but I thought it was a really great blog post.
Yeah.
And then I think there's also maybe for the secret detection, there's like maybe auto-generating regexes for your custom patterns. And then I think there was also a one-off blog post on using LLMs to help speed up maybe source and sync writing for CodeQL or something like that as well. But yeah, that's I'm curious if there's other cases that you all have. So this is like already a lot of things, but I'm curious. If there's other around, I don't know, like detection and response, or I think there was also when you talked about lots of different repos, lots of discussions being happening in like snippets, things like that. I could imagine as a security engineer, I would love to sort of suck up all that data and be like, oh, it looks like this discussion in this repo based on this potential proposed feature. Like, oh, that seems like something that we might want to do a security review of, or the previous threat model of this application or microservices maybe changing in terms of like, oh, it used to be read only, but they're thinking about it's like, oh, now it's going to accept file uploads or something that's like meaningfully changing like how much security risk is associated with that service. So yeah, any other stuff you're thinking about?
I mean, I think all those are great use cases. You know, what I find interesting about the AI space is right now, so I'll give you a generalized comment and then we can touch on some of those specifics. Right now, what I think is interesting is the most mileage that we sort of see from, and I'm not even just talking about what GitHub is doing, but when you look at where people are building delightful AI experiences right now, are you have a significant change to the way people interact with the service, which primarily right now, the dominant way that people are having something novel there is through a chat interface. So this, we can thank ChatGPT for this, but that is changing how people interact with data and interface with their systems in a way that I think is significant. But in general, when I think about like, well, where should you do AI? Cause you could sort of AIify whatever, right? I mean, you can prioritize kind of infinitely many things, but there are a couple constraints there. One is things can be expensive. Two is there are not an infinite number of GPUs out there for any given organization to just go AIify all the use cases, and these things cost money. So, you know, I would advise certainly people who are thinking about, well, what other workflows can we benefit from AI, to just think through like, what's a use case that really lends itself well to being 10 times better through AI. And certainly when you look at like GitHub Copilot, the idea that you have a pair programmer there, I mean, it's absolutely at least 10 times better, because we now know that when GitHub Copilot started, it was writing on average about like 35% of the code for developers who were using it. Now, in some languages, it's as high as 60%, and you know, we're certainly estimating that over the course of the next several years, that number will get up into the 80s. So, I mean, this is like a significant change in how people are writing code. But if you think about like a SOC analyst, what I think there's a ton of opportunity in places like that to reshape those workflows, because, you know, your average stock analyst has a lot of creative freedom in how they do their job, right? They have practices and processes, but there's a high degree of variability in terms of like the experiences of the analyst, their context and knowledge on the threats or the systems that they're looking at. And, you know, you don't necessarily have, you can't necessarily have a high degree of consistency as a result of that. So thus you go try to find the people who have kind of like had a lot of lived experience in incident response, or they end up being very valuable. Mm-hmm. But if you have a tool that transforms like how you do some of that triaging, or that helps you through the flow of incident response, which, you know, like there's plenty of standards out there that sort of describe in a generalized way, the flow of incident response, feels like those are places where you can see just huge beneficial opportunities. Because rather than having to go to 10 different tools, if you can just say, show me all the places that this has, you know, that I've seen this indicator of compromise previously, and you're able to benefit from an experience built on top of an LLM that is built on top of your data to give you a very fast answer that would otherwise have probably taken you hours to run down as an incident handler. These are the kinds of things that I think are like highly disruptive in a good way. So where I'm bullish is on things that are boilerplate, things that are things that we take for granted as being really important, but really generally time inefficient or labor intensive. Those are the kinds of places where I feel like AI makes a big dent very, very quickly in things and becomes like a worthwhile endeavor to invest in. So if you look at like where GitHub has done some of those AI investments, obviously, again, in the IDE is a super effective place to actually interact and make a developer's life better. But code scanning as well, same thing. Like if you're a developer, you think about like the whole spectrum of the software development lifecycle. It starts with, I'm bringing an idea to code, and doesn't end, but the other end of that spectrum ends up being, you know, I'm deploying and operating something. Well, most of the time, the security feedback that you get is sort of around that like CI/CD timeframe. And the industry has called that shifting left for, more than 10 years at this point. But the real shift left now with AI, if the pair programmer is actually better at security than you are, which it is in these cases, that's actually as far shifted left as you can get, because now you actually have somebody with you all the time that's giving you suggestions that are safer by default, more secure by default, and benefit from that corpus of knowledge. And by the way, we'll only get better as the models and the experiences improve over time. So I think about that as like, there's really strategic places to inject this, but it's also important to remember that it's called Copilot, not Autopilot. And it's not to say that, well, because we now have security capabilities as part of the pair programmer, that we don't need all this other stuff. On the contrary, I think it gives you better mileage for the security capability that you're doing in other places. And you certainly want to add AI to places like code scanning as well to make those better. But you still need to have a comprehensive security program across the board to get those things done. I will say, you know, I mentioned earlier, we've been using Copilot now for almost 3 years internally. Certainly our engineers are happy with it and are, you know, seeing stats that are sort of on par with what we've said publicly about how much code is being written by Copilot. But we have not had to scale or do things differently from a security standpoint to account for the fact that Copilot is part of our team. In that sense. So we don't see a material change in the number of bugs that we have. We haven't needed to change our staffing model for code review. And again, even we see statistics from actually talking to developers about their code experiences that suggest the vast majority of engineers are actually more confident and complete code reviews faster when they benefit from something like Copilot. So I think there's, you know, again, it's early, right? Like we're sort of in the first or maybe even the second inning of what AI is doing around developer tools. And there's already been a lot of change in the last 2 years. So I feel like there's, again, just continues to be tremendous opportunity ahead of us to see the fruits of AI and solving some of the challenges and opportunities that are coming up as we figure out how to put AI in the right places to positively impact things.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things about that. One of the things, I was going to ask you about you said, you know, GitHub itself, maybe a non-trivial amount of code is being written by Copilot, and you haven't actually noticed a difference in bug density, nor have you adopted your security review process. So yeah, that was a big thing I was going to ask you, but that's very interesting.
There's no peg of additional staffing that we put into the model that says, well, because Copilot, we need more security engineers. That has not been the experience, and there's been no discernible change in the defect rates that we've had. Now, again, we're always maturing all the time. I mean, security is not ever something that you're done with, as you know, right? It's it's like training for a marathon. It's one of those things you're just constantly working on improving over time, but you never really complete that training. But you know, again, from our perspective, it's resulted in no material changes to how we've thought about you know, our security staffing model or how much work or vulnerability analysis we've had to do from that perspective, which I think is a good outcome.
Yeah, that's a great outcome. A friend of mine who it's maybe not worth the time here to get into the details, but he and I were having dinner recently, and a colleague of his had submitted a new PR that was written by ChatGPT, and there was actually a very subtle logic bug in terms of it was supposed to measure the performance of something, and basically the way in which it did it was like subtly wrong, such that it kind of looked believable. Yeah. But if you like, you had to kind of have like some meta understanding of what you're trying to do to like understand. So yep. Personally, I totally agree with you. I think I've had it written, ChatGPT write scripts for me that are like one-off scripts that actually worked the first time, and to do some like basic number crunching and visualization that I could have written, but it would have taken me a long time, and it just wrote it fully working first try. It was like 50 lines of code, but I was like, hey, this saved me some time, and it was great. So I think I'm very bullish on the future. I think, to your point, things are only getting better. But I guess one thing that's yet to be determined in my mind is there's sometimes like subtle logic things where if you could imagine across like a gigantic code base, there could be implicit assumptions in the code, and maybe parts of this goes away as the models get better and as the context windows get bigger. Maybe this becomes less of an issue, but I don't know. It's promising, but I think it still merits, like any code, to your point, it's not full self-driving. I think it still merits like hard thinking people who are reviewing it, both from the eng and security point of view. But overall, I think useful.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree with you totally. I mean, it's the like, we've been promised for some time now that we'll have self-driving cars with no steering wheels in them, and it's 2024. And I mean, every car I see on the road has a steering wheel and a human in the driver's seat still. So, which is not meant to say that that anybody's been wrong or ill intent there, but more just noting that it's really hard to achieve full autonomy in that respect. And that's why I said, you know, over the next couple of years, you know, I would not be surprised at all to see something like GitHub Copilot writing closer to 80% of code. But it's also very true that people need to be thoughtful about making sure that they don't take for granted the fact that you still need a full suite of software security development lifecycle capabilities that you would have with or without AI. I mean, again, as we alluded to earlier in the call, there's sort of, you could have infinitely many security people and still wish you had more in your organization. And because of scarcity and structural problems in the labor market, you're just never going to even need to address that problem in the first place. So there's always going to be work to do on that front. But what I think about is, much like the incident response example we talked a minute ago about, if you can clear out a lot of the low-hanging fruit, or you can even clear out, whether it's low-hanging fruit or not, some chunk of what otherwise would have been vulnerable code or code with defects by virtue of having an AI pair programmer that's good at security, or some other security-enabled capability that helps you get to a better outcome. Even if it's not perfect, that's why you have code review. That's still why you have threat modeling. That's why you have vulnerability analysis folks. That's why you have scanning taking place at CI/CD time. That's why you have incident response for when you actually ship something to production. Those things all need to remain true. And I would say, hopefully we'll continue to make progress in each of those other disciplines as well, so that we can continue to work on sort of more higher order and more complex tasks. But, you know, I also think a benefit of that is like, it's engaging to work on the harder stuff, right? So if you're clearing out a lot of stuff with something like Copilot, and that changes your focus onto some other interesting and novel tasks, this can actually be a great like growth experience for you as a security practitioner, if you get to work on other things, and you're kind of clearing out some of the more rote stuff, if you will. So I am also bullish on what this looks like. And people need to keep their hands on the wheel while this space continues to develop.
Agreed. Yeah, there's a lot of just sort of like small tactical rote things that sometimes still there's some toil around, like making sure you do the basics right. So yeah, totally agree. If some system or collection of tools could solve that, so that you could work on just bigger picture, more complex, like higher leverage things, I think that would be totally a win for everyone. So moving maybe a little bit into the future and sort of hand wavily describing what that might look like. One thing you said that I really liked is like, what does like actually shifting left look like, right? So maybe 20 years ago, it was like, hey, you built this thing 6 months ago. Here's a 1,000-page PDF on all the things that you need to fix. And then sort of the original shift left was doing scanning in sort of the PR workflow or something like that. And I think that that's good and still provides a lot of value and is probably always going to be a early-ish checkpoint. But to your point, like ideally in the IDE, and there's some things like some tools run very quickly and they're almost like a linting that can happen pre-commit or post-save or something like that. But I thought it might be fun to sort of like brainstorm for a bit, like what would like true shifting left look like and how might, so to my knowledge, you know, so Copilot has its own, has like its own model, which is great. But let's say I'm a individual company and I have maybe some of my internal code guidelines or like the security team is like, hey, you know, we use this for secrets management or, you know, here's maybe some secure wrapper libraries we have like, what do you think either in the near or maybe more medium term future, what could that look like? Because probably, I don't know, does that look like each org has like a fine-tuned Copilot or is it more of like RAG? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I mean, we are working on fine-tuning for customers who want that. So for customers who want a set of interactions that is a, you know, that reflects what is already in their code base and their set of capabilities, we're working on that. So that's certainly part of it. You know, and I do think the shift left, like if you think about like, well, how far left do you shift? Well, first off, it's worth noting, and we've said this, but I do think it's worth repeating. Shift left does not mean don't do anything over here. It means you want security value. Really what this means is like you want security value to be added in the place where it is most efficient and has the highest impact. And I believe that if you go back to what I said was one of GitHub's thesis around security, that security starts with the developer, that interaction at the point in time that you are bringing your idea to code through the keyboard in your editor, that is one of the most effective places that you can have security interactions and feedback. Now, we have to still design those experiences such that they're fast. We find that latency matters a lot when you're suggesting code in terms of people actually accepting those suggestions. So we have to make sure that that's always fast. But I do believe that that is one of the places that's going to continue to have a big impact. But what I'll note in terms of like looking into the future, this is great for new stuff that you're writing. This is not great for all the stuff that we've had for decades that we rely on. And in fact, it really doesn't actually do much at all to solve those problems. So, you know, we on the one hand like to say, well, banks and others are still running on COBOL, but there's challenges to be solved there as well to modernize a lot of the critical infrastructure and open source code that has become part of critical infrastructure around the world. And I'm sure you remember last summer, the folks at DARPA and at OpenSSF launched the, you know, the AI cyber challenge. And I think this is good, right? To be investing in some of these other bigger challenges, because the reality is not every organization today, obviously, is using an AI pair programmer. It's still relatively new on the scene, though certainly the adoption's been phenomenal to watch. And we're getting great feedback from customers. But clearly not everybody is using it today. We obviously do give it away for free to open source developers, and we see a lot of uptake on that front as well. But there's just all this other stuff that we rely on that hasn't been touched in a long time. And I like to refer to the Log4j event as a good example of code that was written years ago is going to be the thing that surprises you. And how do you think through like addressing that or at scale scanning and addressing and identifying fixes for and interacting with the maintainers of projects to resolve issues in that space? Because, you know, fixing your first party code and all the stuff you're writing henceforth, great. You're probably also writing it in memory safe languages, hopefully, in a lot of these cases. Like, we're making a lot of good decisions that will pay dividends 10, 15, 20 years down the road today. And I feel like the wind is blowing in the right direction on that front. But there's the everything behind us that is going to be a really big challenge for the industry. I believe AI as a royal theme unlocks the possibility that we can make meaningful progress on that. And, you know, as a bit of a critique on like where we are today, Log4j wasn't that long ago. And certainly I think there's been some good things that have come out of that in terms of elevating the conversation around supply chain security, around open source security, around how we think about better supporting the software and the communities that power really every commercial business, every experience that you have, every day critical infrastructure that keeps us safe on a day-to-day basis. We've elevated the conversation, but I also think the next Log4j is just as likely to happen today or tomorrow as it is, you know, to happen again a month after that, or 6 months after that, or a year from now. I mean, like we haven't really prevented that moment from coming back again. And that's not a critique of the Log4j maintainers, but it's just a reality that we haven't actually gone back and fixed meaningfully and gotten to some assurances on a lot of that code. So my hope is that AI, we can find and work together both as a set of private industries, but also with the public sector and some of these other working groups like the OpenSSF to figure out how to attack some of those challenges where we actually go back and look at the things that we're dependent on and, you know, fund refactoring some of them into memory safe languages or going back and using the magic of something like autofix at scale to help us detect and fix security vulnerabilities and open source dependencies. But there are going to be some big digs that need to happen in that space to help us get better. So, you know, it's the shift left and that's great. And that's improving everything we're doing henceforth. But I think a lot about the everything else that's certainly been more top of mind for me in the last several months. And again, my hope is AI is the differentiator that allows us to make more meaningful progress in that.
I like that. And yeah, totally agree that there's this massive amount of existing code, probably has had much less security maturity and analysis than modern written stuff. And yeah, I think it's very likely to me, in my opinion, that that'll bite us. Could you imagine?
Oh, I'm sure, probably several more times, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. That may never be the case, because in 10 years, what we're writing today maybe is going to be much less mature than what we're writing 10 years from now, hopefully. In terms of maybe AI helping with prior code, you mentioned, I was imagining potentially as some sort of like auto fix at scale, or you can imagine maybe even, I think you see models like translating between human languages, between programming languages. So you can imagine like, hey, there's not a lot of COBOL developers. Maybe we could start rewriting this COBOL into like Java or something that is maybe more modern, maintained, has more people who can read and edit it more effectively. So I guess I'm curious if you think those are reasonable approaches, or maybe you would propose something else in terms of like autofix, auto rewriting into a new language. Like, how else do you think AI could maybe help there?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are good examples, Clint, of like places where AI could be the difference maker. But I also think even with some of like what's on the truck today, for example, the vast majority of developers get into development, like in open source, but also commercially at this point, not necessarily by going to like a traditional 4-year computer science program anymore. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just get in by finding a cool open source project, bringing a shovel and saying, how can I help? And learning from the community, learning by doing. And what's cool is AI and experiences built in and around AI have actually opened up like whole new ways of learning. So if you think about like chat interfaces, I find that in particular for me, that is something that works well for my learning style. Mm-hmm. And it's like having a staff engineer who knows everything about your code base sitting right next to you, because you can say, you know, hey, help me understand what's going on here, or show me some of the bugs in this code, or how might I refactor this function to be, you know, more efficient or have better runtime. You can do all that stuff. And then you can say, great, now explain to me like why we did it that way. And where I'm excited about that is, again, we've talked a little bit about there's a shortage of security expertise generally. And even in the context of like private sector companies sort of doing volunteer firefighter work, that's not a permanent fix. And in many cases where you can run into challenges is if we say, here's a pot of money, or here's, you know, the SEAL Team 6 of software security, and we're going to parachute in and fix, some very popular top 100 open source library that we care about. Oftentimes the project is not necessarily going to be prepared or have the resources or, again, the expertise to keep at that level that the experts might be able to bring it up to. Mm-hmm. And And if anything, you can actually saddle them with things that they then have to maintain after the fact that can, again, just be difficult for the maintainers to reconcile. So I think a lot about like, how do you overcome some of those challenges in a more permanent and structural way? And I think part of those is just, again, opening people up to getting more access to security knowledge and expertise. And if chat is one of those ways that people can learn or can ask questions about security or ask questions about the security of the code that they're looking at and get advice and fixes, I feel like that's great, right? Because if you're not comfortable with a scanner, but you're comfortable asking a question, that's great. That's just another new way for people to get involved and experience the joy of security and get excited about security, but also get very practical help. So I think there's other spaces, you know, in addition to some of the bigger things that you talked about, which I think are all great, even just improving access to A, being a developer, right? Because this is a whole new way to get into development. It's having a conversation with an agent, but also helping developers have easier access to security information. If you don't know a security engineer, but now you can just ask your chat, I mean, this is great.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's an excellent example. And I have seen some tutorials with some people being like, hey, here's like a detailed prompt for how do I learn anything? And it basically will create like a custom mini curriculum for you about like, hey, you're learning Python programming for the first time. Here's some of the core concepts. And it'll even be like, hey, now write a for loop, and it'll like then like auto like grade it for you. And I think I've seen some exciting applications from learning just any topic. And yeah, maybe like some of the details are not 100% correct, but if you're just starting directionally, it's probably quite good. And
yeah, 100%. No, I think it's a great way to get started. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, if you can build, you know, if you can build some confidence, build some of the basic fluency, it actually ends up making it more important that we teach people how to ask the right questions, or that the experiences that we build on the models can help hint you as to what other questions you might want to ask as follow-ups. That actually becomes a really important part, I think, of how you end up building those experiences to help people make progress in terms of crystallizing some of that knowledge, and then having the experiences meant to actually solidify that that learning and put it into practice. But again, I like very bullish that new ways of learning will help arm more people with the knowledge and skills needed to positively contribute on that. Again, maybe not make them a security expert, but make them security effective in more contexts.
Definitely, and at scale, which would be great.
And it's
So, Mike, this has been an awesome chat. Just in the last few minutes, I thought we could maybe do a few like quick takes where you could maybe spicy, maybe not, maybe just normal, but just a couple sort of like rapid fire quick things. I'm curious. So we've been talking about a lot of good area or potential good applications of AI in security. I'm curious if you think either today or in general, are there some areas of security that you feel like are not really well suited for AI, at least today, or maybe always?
Good question. Generally, I love security investments and security improvements in areas that make the basics cheaper and easier for people to comply with. So I'll note that it's the calendar year 2024, and we are still telling people all the time to turn on two-factor authentication, which pains me greatly. So, you know, I would say for an organization that's looking at like, hey, what's next for AI? You know, it's a good question to ask, and certainly I think it's important to the organization, but I would also go back and say, hey, if you think about a hierarchy of needs pyramid, you know, like there's basics at the bottom, and like, have we really focused on being excellent at those? And frankly, a lot of organizations have not. So it's good to be thinking about AI. It's good to be thinking about how to adopt it, but making sure that it doesn't take your eye off the ball of the really critical stuff is key. And unfortunately in 2024, it's clear still that far too many organizations are not brilliant at the basics, and the incentives have not forced people to get good at that.
Agreed. Yeah, it's always the fundamentals. So over the next year or two, do you think AI is going to give attackers or defenders more advantage? It's probably helping both, but who do you feel like it's helping more?
Yeah, it's probably helping both. That said, this is the case with every technology that we've ever had in security, and AI will just be the next version of that, where attackers will seek to get and leverage advantage from that in the same way that defenders will. It's the classic cat and mouse game. I think my take on this is more, we shouldn't let fear and uncertainty about what is possible for attackers to hold us back from doing the hard work to make it work for defenders and integrate it into defense workflows. If you don't do that, guess what? The bad guys don't care. They're going to continue to invest in making AI work for them anyway. So my big charge there is keep focused on like where this can make a big dent on the defensive side. That's the key to success in the future.
Yeah, agreed. But if you had to choose maybe in the near future and then maybe in like 10 years, do you feel like which side it helps yep. more?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably a push, though I'd say on the defensive side, even you think about it, like we're largely focused on AI for productivity purposes at this point. I think that's partially from the macroeconomic climate, but that's largely been the use case today. But we're seeing tons of security advantages, and it's not even been the primary focus for most people who are building AI tools for like in the developer setting and context. So it's like, great, if it's not even the primary thing and we're realizing tons of advantages from that without it being the primary focus point, I'm actually pretty bullish on what it means for defenders. I think we'll see novel attacker stuff. Like in self-driving cars, we saw when people put tape on the stop sign, you can crash a Tesla. That paper was, what, 3 or 4 years old? But it's not the case that magically everybody who had a Tesla ended up being in a car crash either. So I think we have to really, again, be responsible, objective threat modelers around how likely is it that some of the adversarial work becomes a problem at scale relative to how well can we scale up the defensive work that's enabled by AI? So I am actually bullish here for the defenders in both the short term and the long term.
Nice. Yeah, I feel like if I had to hand wavily guess, I feel like maybe some attacker advantage in the short term because maybe they're adopting it more quickly and specifically focusing on offense, whereas we're maybe thinking about productivity and other things. Yep. But similarly, I'm bullish in the long term that I feel like net on net, eventually, I feel like defenders will get more benefit yeah. from it, if I had to guess.
My guess is we'll see some like, you know, small number of headline news things in the short term. But again, I still feel like defenders will win out in the short and the
long. Yeah. Along those lines, last question. If you had to like pie in the sky, let's say models keep increasing significantly year on year, like context windows are like exploding. Vast amounts of more training. So let's say in like 10 years, which I feel like an AI is like 100 years, I'm curious, what does maybe cybersecurity look like to you and maybe the development process?
Great question. Security, the big thing that my hope is in 10 years is we won't feel so behind. I mean, I mentioned a minute ago, it's 2024. We're still telling people to turn on two-factor authentication and patch their endpoints. Ransomware is wildly popular, not because there's some cache of exotic zero days kicking around. It's because it's really hard to get patching right. Like it's just really, really hard for enterprises and organizations mm-hmm. to do that. So my hope is that AI can get us to the point where we're not behind all the time and not reacting all the time for security. That would be my wish over the course of the next 10 years, is the security is more at pace or more proactive than it is today. That would be my big wish there. For development as a whole, it's interesting to think about, like, again, I believe more in the idea that it will continue to be a co-pilot rather than an autopilot, particularly in the near and medium term. Long term, who knows, but let's say near and medium term. I think the good news is this actually creates a ton of jobs. This creates a ton of opportunity. This creates a ton of accelerated progress because more people will be able to be developers. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to get into development easier. They will have more help in getting into it and learning it quickly. And that will dramatically accelerate and multiply many times over the amount of code or the amount of progress that we can make for humans with technology. So I think about quality of life, changes in the cost of things, the changes in the efficiency of things that we can realize through AI feels all really great for humanity in a more royal sense. So very excited about that and the idea that developers can really be driving that. But a change there will be less focused on like your experiential knowledge and expertise of a language or of using a language and its set of primitives to build a thing. And it will probably shift to some degree on your ability to like effectively interact with models. And that's why it's sort of an interesting question of like, well, how do you know what questions to ask or what kinds of questions to ask? And people have talked about like prompt engineering, for example, as part of this. But, you know, I think there's probably a more like royal field of study there of like, for the kids today who are growing up and are going to get into coding tomorrow, we actually want them to be good thinkers and know how to ask smart, thoughtful, novel questions. Those will actually probably be the things that start helping set them apart if all else is equal in terms of access to a model and access to knowledge. So kind of probably some interesting things to think about there just in terms of how we educate people going forward if this will be the primary way that we interact with knowledge.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, that's going to be very exciting. Well, Mike, I've had a blast chatting with you. Thanks so much for your time. Are there any things you want to say about how people should find you or maybe resources you want to point people towards or any parting advice?
Yeah, sure. So you know, you can find me on LinkedIn and on Twitter and of course on GitHub. My handle's mph4 on GitHub. And you know, for anybody out there who's interested in getting into security or who's had a lot of experience in security, we're hiring at GitHub and we'd love to hear from you. And if you're new to security and you're just looking for like what kind of approach to take or where to start, start from that approach of how do you get to yes, be the department of yes and, or the analyst or the engineer of yes and figure out how to both help the business go fast and get things done and meet security goals. That's going to be the way we do security from here on out in effective organizations. So hopefully folks take that mindset to heart in their day-to-day work.
Yeah, I love that. Totally agree. Well, have a wonderful rest of your day and take care, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, Clint. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.